are you building a sales and marketing company or are you building an education company? There's no shortcut to solving for acquisition except word of mouth. If you build great products and great content, it is akin to great library. But you still go to your school or university not for the library, but for the full education.
Mayank, I love how nuanced you've made it.
And education, it's not an instant gratification product. It's not like eating a Maggie and say, "Arey, bahut acha taste hai, fir se lete." Nobody wants to spend on their education.
Correct.
And I have to convince you, yeah, spend karo, spend karo, spend karo. We make 8 mistakes and we make 2 successful decisions. Those mistakes are a lot more important than the 2 or 3 successes that you end up getting. Sometimes you have to just ask the only question you need to ask, what's the worst that can happen?
What does it take to run a hugely successful edtech startup? How does a startup deploy its own capital? How does a founder share equity with his or her team members? How do they deploy their own personal capital? Today, I chat with Mayank Kumar, MD and co-founder of Upgrad, on the Create Wealth podcast with me, Sandeep Chetfani. Mayank, from the outside in, education business right now seems like a really tough business to be in. There's a lot of interesting news flow around this particular industry, especially in the context of edtech. Why does it seem like such a tough business to be in? What are the challenges, either in customer acquisition, the costs, repeat rates? Like, talk to us about a little bit about that.
Just the industry or one company?
Okay, so that's up to you. We'll be happy to get a bite.
Thank you for having me here today. But on a serious note, look, I think when you look at the education ecosystem, some of the times, fundamentally, what people have confused education/edtech as a sales and marketing engine.
Okay.
So a lot of people are focused on building great distribution network that can reach out to the customer really fast. And many companies have built that. I mean, if you look at what a lot of MOOCs platform did, they were solving for access.
So what platform is this?
The MOOCs platform, the massive open online courses. So what they tried doing was, if you do not have access to good quality content from great universities, I'll provide you that.
Sure.
A lot of next generation sort of companies that came in tried to leverage the education product with a very disruptive sales force. I think in the case of what happened in the Indian education tech ecosystem was a lot of field sales that will go to your house, knock on the door and say, do you want to buy a product?
Sure.
And therefore, they managed to build a great sales and marketing engine. But in education, one of the things that you definitely need to ask is, are you building a sales and marketing company or are you building an education company? And therefore, to your specific question, the companies that are struggling have focused a lot on distribution and sales and marketing, but not enough on outcomes. And companies that are focused on outcomes, they have tend to done, I mean, they have done much better. So I'll give you some examples. So in test prep, it's very easy to measure outcome. Aapka hua ki aapka nahi hua.
Correct.
Did you get in or did you not get in? And therefore, you will see test prep companies doing really well. Traditionally, offline companies, I mean, you are seeing that the big offline companies, resurgence of those in the context of digital ecosystem.
And they do well, Mayank, because you know that whether the person cleared the exam or got a decent score, and that would translate to word of mouth because they would talk to others about where they studied.
So wherever outcomes are easy to measure and companies are focusing on those outcomes, they do much better.
Sure.
So test prep being one.
Yeah.
In the case of where we are, which is in the adult learning, lifelong learning and skilling, executive education, again, the results are easy to measure, which is salary hike hui ki nahi hui. Did you get a better job? Did you get a promotion? Did you move from role A to role B? And therefore, people come to us because they believe that there is an outcome that is linked to it.
Sure.
So if there is outcome, so my fundamental point of view is that any company that ignores outcome will struggle to scale. But companies that focus, the company that focus on outcomes, they will do really well because of exactly what you said. It leads to outcome, satisfaction, word of mouth, repeat, referral, and the entire cycle happens. Because in education, one of the big challenges is that the Achilles heel is acquisition. There is no shortcut to solving for acquisition except word of mouth. And the only way word of mouth can be solved if the experience is really good and there's outcome associated. So I tend to call education as an outcome business. If you do outcomes, you will build a business.
And therefore, for some of the companies which have struggled in this segment, let's say somebody in the K to 12 ecosystem.
There's no outcome there.
There's no outcome, and therefore they needed a high amount of sales motion.
Correct.
Which is counterproductive in Correct. Some sense.
So if you go back, and this is something we can talk about, there used to be this company that was providing class teaching pedagogy, projector and smart classes, right? Yeah. I mean, if you remember, 2008, 2009, 2010, there was a boom of smart classes.
Yeah.
And everybody took smart classes.
Mm.
But it was not leading to any outcome change in the context of schools.
Got it.
So therefore, it all came in. The renewals and the repeat rates were sub 50%.
Yeah.
And the company shut down.
Mm.
Same is the case in some of the school education where you come in and you take up a lot of advantage of sales and marketing, you ramp up, outcome does not happen, and therefore repeats, renewals does not end up happening.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. I don't know, I grew up in a very small town in Assam. At that point of time, there used to be this salesman who would come and sell this a set of 15 Britannica.
Yes, I remember. Yeah,
Book of Whys, Book of Whos, etc.
Everyone would buy it because their neighbors would also buy it.
So everybody buys it because somebody else has bought it. Yeah. And the guy used to play very smartly. He would say, "Ek kharidoge to 100 rupay ka hai, 15 kharidoge to 500 rupay ka hai."
Correct.
And you would buy all set. You will buy the entire set. So you will not buy 1 year course. You will buy 7 year course.
Yeah.
Something similar that happened in education space.
Hmm.
And they would come and you will purchase it largely because of FOMO. Ki yaar uska bachche ke paas hai to mere bachche ke paas bhi hona chahiye.
Correct.
But how do you keep it? You keep it in your drawing room. I used to keep it in our drawing room behind those shelf where we used to keep, like, there was a glass shelf, right? Yeah. It was a transparent shelf. So
yes.
I can show off that I have it.
Yes.
I would never open it.
Yeah.
And then after that, 3 years later, the salesman again came. Nobody bought it.
Yeah.
Because everybody knew that it was not to be used. It was just a showpiece. It was bought on FOMO.
Right.
I think something similar happened in education space where they came in and said, "Ek saal ka tuition kyun? 7 saal ka lo.
Right.
Aapko saste milega."
Correct.
But when users did not happen, outcomes did not happen, the renewals took a beating.
And therefore, is it that some of these guys underinvested in the delivering the outcome actually? Was that the mistake, or fundamentally the K-12 is not suited for a quote-unquote edtech experience?
So partly, yes, K-12 is not suited, but I still believe that if you can deliver some outcomes, ki yaar aapka bachcha aaya tha, uski 93% pe score chal raha tha, you'll get to 97-98%. But some of these outcomes are also gamed in the sense that if you see the board results over a period of the last 15-20 years, there has been grade inflation. So agar aapka bachcha 2 saal ke baad board exam de raha, they will tend to do better. So the measure is not very clear. It's not very sort of discernible, so to say. And therefore, that's a challenge. But it can be still solved. But if you look at what happened in the school space in the K-12 ecosystem, was that they did a phenomenal job in cracking acquisition. I think the company's built a massive engine. The engine that will go into your houses, that will come and purchase. I think that was one of the biggest innovation that happened in the distribution channel in the context of education.
So the innovation was in the distribution, not in the technology or delivery.
Not in the technology. I think, but I must say that the product that some of these companies had built were phenomenal. I think the content that I see in some of these platforms are really good. It is world class. But that was not linked to that outcome. And as I say that you can build a great in education, you have to also realize that if you build great products and great content, it is akin to great library. But you still go to your school or university not for the library, but for the full education. So without the delivery, which is essentially about follow up and ensuring that you are completing the program, you are going through the journey, education does end up becoming little bit like accessing libraries. Libraries are never $1 billion plus in terms of revenue, etc. But you have university that are at $40-50 billion plus in terms of endowment. And that's the difference between library and education. So I think one was sales and marketing versus outcome. The second is library versus support and delivery.
Mayank, I love how nuanced you've made it, because if you keep the corporate governance and all of those issues aside, there was a fundamental issue in the business model in itself. But tell me this, like, I feel like the outcomes are delayed in most of these kind of situations, even to a certain extent in UpGrad, because only after the course is over, maybe a year or two down the line, will you see the result of that. And therefore, there is a delayed word of mouth that would happen. How do you deal with the cold start problem, or how did UpGrad deal with the cold start problem?
See, it's not very different with what the wealth industry is.
Yeah.
I think when you look at education, part of people look at education as a mutual fund industry. that if I'm putting in 100, I need to get 120.
Correct.
But, and part of people look at education as insurance sector.
Hmm.
If the shit hits the fan, I have something to fall back on.
Sure.
Kuch nahi to degree to hai.
Hmm.
If nothing happens, I can say I'm a B.Tech, I'm a MBA, etc., etc. So I think there's both the phenomena. And if you look at wealth industry and insurance industry or mutual fund and insurance, they also struggle with the cold start problem, right?
Correct.
I mean, mutual fund sahi hai, nahi hota, then people would not have come and
right.
invested. It takes some time, but it gets to that place. But I'll come to your question slightly later. And education is not like, it's not an instant gratification product. It's not like eating a Maggie and say, arre, bahut acha taste hai, fir se lete. And therefore, you have to find, you have to come out as a product which is slightly capturing a very strong need in the market initially.
Okay.
And that strong need has to be something like, I mean, in the case of COVID, a lot of people came in and said, we can learn online in your home, etc., etc. And that picked up really well. In our case, we captured the trend of skills becoming obsolete.
Okay.
And we went in with that problem statement that, dekho, outcomes ek saal baad aega, do saal baad aega. For the first 1 year, I have to fight very aggressively on a very macro theme, which is that IT sector increments were at 3-5% only. Everybody was struggling how to sort of move up. We said, if you do data, if you do AI, if you do cyber, if you do the new age technology, you can move from 5% to 15 or 30%.
Got it.
That was understood by people. And therefore, we gave them a promise without showing them the promise. But it took us about 6 months to a year to demonstrate the promise. And once the promise started coming in, a lot of referrals started flowing in. But initially, you have to find something which is very unique and differentiated, which others are not doing at that point of time. And that's what you need to capitalize on. The beauty in the beauty in the K through 12 space was that there was an existing market of tuition, coaching, learning. In adult learning, it's not existing. Like nobody, I mean, I don't think anybody of us spend on our own education ever.
Outside of universities and
correct,
colleges.
Yeah. So if you ask everybody the question that education spend is whatever, 6-8% is what the latest sort of survey suggested. But it is all your child's education. You never spend on your own. So as a kid, you want your parents to spend on yourself. As you become older, you want the companies to spend on you, or you spend on your kids' education. But there's never a concept of self-spend on education. It's very rare to find it in India. And I think that to solve for that, you have to play on a very differentiated need that aaj ke time pe, this is a shiny object. Let's start there. And then you build on top of that.
I'll come to the buyer versus user issue, which I
think is a big issue also in K-12.
And also, I wonder if it's in your business also, because at least some part of it would be paid by the parent, but I'll come back to that. The question is that how did the initial go-to-market happen? Was it a sales-led motion, or was it digital marketing? Was it content? What got UpGrad off the ground
initially? So I think I would say content and the program.
Okay.
I think we identified, our first program was entrepreneurship. So we played on the mindset in 2015 that everybody was thinking of startup.
So this was the early wave of startups happening.
Yeah, startups coming in. We said, okay, entrepreneurship, let's just see a strong product. The second unique insight that we had was data science was becoming very big at that point of time. So we played on that product proposition that agar aap data science karoge, to aap 5% ki jagah 15% hike leke jaoge. I think these two initial sort of program identification and the content identification allowed us to reach to that level. We started our first program, you won't believe, so we were looking at enrolling about 100 students and that too paying us 2 lakh rupees per person. So it was 2 crore business.
And this was in 2015.
2015, right?
Which 2 lakhs is a
massive
amount of
money. Nobody was doing it. The max online program was priced at about 15,000-30,000, and we said, "No, ek saal ka hai, ROI hai, 2 lakh pe price karte hain, nine month of long program." We priced it 2 lakh, 100 students. I remember we got to 50, we crossed 100, we got to 150, we pushed. We finally ended the first cohort, which was at 100 capacity at 300. 300 people paid that 2 lakh rupees.
6 crore rupees of inflow you had.
Yeah,
there.
And we did not do much of marketing. We hardly did marketing.
Okay.
And we just got the people because our product was differentiated and people came in with that thought process. After we got a few products right, then we had to invest in sales and marketing to drive the growth of it. But initially, I believe that it's a very strong product proposition that gets you a foot in the door. Uske baad aapko, you have to spend on marketing and sales to scale that up from there on.
So then it seems like to keep CACs low, you almost have to keep innovating and identifying new gaps in them.
Yeah, so I think we innovated with that thought process of data science and entrepreneurship. Very soon we realized that a lot of people are doing our online program and then they want But we are not offering them masters. We are offering them only diplomas or sort of PG program, certificate, etc. So we created a pathway to convert their what they learned for 6 months into a master's program. So that innovation got us many more students coming in because now they felt, oh, I have done this much, thoda sa aur karke master's mil jayega. So a significant jump came in. Then we added, online hi kyun karna hai, aap offline karo, study abroad jaake karo. And that opened up a new market for us. Then over a period of time, we launched, I mean, right now, one of our biggest selling program is a program on doctorate program. A lot of people are looking at doctorate program, bootcamp programs in data science, full stack, AI, which is not an university program. So I think in education, you are absolutely right that there has to be constant innovation. You will have one or two evergreen products like MBAs, so on and so forth. But you will have to always constantly innovate on products. Otherwise, the market sort of catches on. And and that's what at least we call it our strength, that we are first to identify the trends and then launch programs which allows us to stay ahead of the market.
Like currently, I saw a lot of artificial intelligence and machine learning courses on the platform, and it seems like that's a trend that people are
GenAI is a massive trend. And GenAI is, I think, I personally, GenAI is like Excel of 95-2000 that everybody have to learn. I mean, everybody has to learn Excel and Word. And you don't need to be a techie to know GenAI. But you need to know basic English and prompts to be able to leverage the GenAI platform. So I'm seeing that a lot of people coming from healthcare industry want to learn GenAI. Legal wants to learn GenAI. Retail sales team wants to learn GenAI because they believe that if they learn, a lot of the work will get easy to do. So I think there's a trend of that. But as I said, not everybody comes. Most people don't come to learn. They only come for the ROI. They just don't want to come to learn in the ecosystem out here.
Absolutely. And, you know, that brings me to the earlier point we were making, that in some cases, the consumer or the learner is paying for the course. And in some cases, I suspect the parent or the sort of main breadwinner of the family is paying for the course. And this buyer versus user dichotomy, wherever it happens in a business or a startup is a hard one to solve for. How does UpGrad deal with that?
So I think when we started UpGrad, one of the reasons everybody asked us that why did you not choose K-12 and why did you choose lifelong learning and sort of higher education, that was precisely the reason why we went to adult learning and professional education, because the customer and the consumer are the same people, same individual. While in the case of K-12, you have the child, you have parents, you have school principal, you have class teacher, you have the real estate owner of the school. You solve for everybody else but for the child. And therefore, we did not want to be in that space where the customer and the consumers are different. And that's why we chose in this space. So in our case, I would say 95% is customer, consumer are the same person.
Got it.
Yeah, there could be sometimes siblings, husband, wife, etc. But they are more individual decision maker rather than five people that we need to convince them on making a decision.
Mayank, it seems like a lot of stuff at UpGrad was very structured, thought through. Were there some of the mistakes that probably some of us don't know about in the journey of building the company?
Massive. I think we made many mistakes in the journey. I think one of our advantages was that as founder group, we knew education really well. So I think from education industry perspective, we brought in some fair bit of...
Because you had invested in that space?
Because we had invested, I'd worked for 5-6 years in just looking at the education sector. So there was a fair bit of understanding of that. But in the process of running a business, there were many mistakes that we sort of ended up doing. I think one early mistake that we sort of... perhaps in the recent time during the pandemic, pandemic hit us. We were at about 300 people. Cut to 3 months into pandemic, we are 1,000 people. So we went from 300 to 1,000 in a 3 to 6 month period. And when you do that kind of rapid scaling, everybody remote, where you have not met three-fourths of the entire organization. It's very difficult to build culture in the process. So I think that rapid scaling, we made fair number of mistakes in that journey because we got to hire people. They were all like, you can imagine how hiring 700 people remotely would have been. And we made, in 3 months, and we made a lot of mistakes in there. Because of that, the culture takes a beating. There is an impact of how you get the teams around, how you sort of rally the sort of troops together.
Yeah.
So that was definitely one sort of mistake. In recent times, we did not innovate enough in terms of products because we felt that, okay, we have reached to a certain level. Let's stabilize the ship and let's ensure that whatever that we have, that gets sold versus innovating. So I think those mistakes happen n number of times. I personally believe that we make 8 mistakes and we make 2 successful decisions.
Yeah.
But those mistakes don't get talked about enough because, I mean, there's not glory to it. But as entrepreneurs, as people who are operationally involved, those mistakes are a lot more important than the 2 or 3 successes that you end up getting.
And even otherwise, I guess there's a power law of decisions also. Like the 2 decisions that you did well probably give you
a disproportionate
outcome.
Because downside kya? Downside to ye ki revenue zero ho jayega.
Correct.
Or revenue nahi aayega. The upside is that revenue can go up 10 times, 20 times, 30 times. So therefore that you are right, absolutely right. That sometimes you have to just ask the only question you need to ask, what's the worst that can happen?
Right.
If you're okay living with the worst, then everything else is an upside.
Yeah. You know, one thing, Mayank, I feel like high gross margin products end up investing a lot in brand. And Upgrad has also built a brand over a period of time. How did you decide at which point to start investing in the brand building of it? Because the initial time must have been more organic, more one-to-one sales happening. Yeah. But at which time did you decide to start sort of do more, say, radio, television, ATL, BTL and all?
See, I think brand building, when people say brand building, they end up talking about media spends.
Sure.
That when you spend on media here.
Because EdTech, that's happened quite aggressively.
So for me, brand is slightly beyond that. Like, I mean, as they say, right? I mean, technically people say brand is what people talk about you behind your back.
Sure.
So for us, a large part of brand building was a strong focus on helping people get their jobs and helping people get the right outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the work that we did. So that people say, okay, Upgrad ke paas, like if you look at our M&A approach, we are the only education company that acquired a placement and staffing company.
Which is Recruit.
Recruit and Wolf. And these two we acquired only because we want to support our learners to find a job.
Mm.
And therefore, when you're helping, that's where the brand was getting built.
Mm.
But beyond a certain level, what we realized was that I'm not able to communicate this goodness to a large number of people.
Mm.
So I think a fair bit of taking the brand building approach or media spend into a different set of media was only after we realized that the product works and the product is delivering outcomes and we have happy customers.
Mm.
So once we knew that is happening, we wanted the story to be heard by a large number of people. And that's where the media spends in television, radio, etc. started coming in.
Mm.
But I still don't call it brand building
because
for me, that is also a marketing spend at the end of the day. I just call it as an amplifying factor that let more people get to know your story because otherwise you can start and shout from this room, but maybe 5 people will hear our story.
Yeah.
And you need more people to come on board. Otherwise, what we're trying to build here is an ecosystem that does not exist.
Hmm.
Nobody wants to spend on their education.
Correct.
And I have to convince you, spend karo.
Correct.
And I think the same was the case in mutual fund, right? About 10 years, 15 years back, the amount that people are investing versus today is a very different journey altogether.
Correct.
Now you have proof of concept. Now you have a 10-year history of investing in public markets and you see the benefit. Education will be similar. 10 saal baad mein aap dekhoge, education will be like, there's a line item for mutual fund ELSS, there's a line item for skilling and learning, there's a line item of healthcare, there's a line item of vacation.
Right.
Education will become a line item in everybody's wallet.
Amazing. That'll be quite cool. Mayank, on this point of brand building, right, a lot of founders, me included, we struggle with how to measure the impact of brand spends. And that seems like a black box, and especially somebody who's coming from a hardcore business background, that struggle is there. How did you look at it? Do you have a framework around that?
So there's a panel that is sitting in Stockholm for the Nobel Prize for measuring the ROI of a brand marketing. No, but actually it's very difficult to measure the ROI. I mean, I think honestly, it's I can come out with 5 or 6 parameters saying that, acha, aapne itne rupee lagaye, aapke, this was your organic traffic, the organic traffic went up from here, that organic traffic gave you this many leads, and that led to this much conversion. There's a way in which you can do some calculation, but like it's very difficult to predict how you get, I mean, you catch a disease, right? I mean, it's very difficult to predict for people like why cancer happens, because there are multiple parameters moving around, and it's not just one impact of one spend and what will it lead to.
Sure.
We have done a couple of sort of large campaigns.
Hmm.
But even today, ROI measurement is a very, very difficult part. I think I put it in such a manner that, look, ye karna hai because we are building the industry. But as you rightly said, it's very difficult to put a number to it that if I'm putting in 100, did I get 120 back or not?
Yeah.
It is a delayed gratification, as you said, in some of the industry. It is, you have to just stay at it and you see the result of that. But if you ask me last time jo kiya tha, what was the ROI, I don't have an answer.
So it seems like brand ROI is a known unknown. And we live with that. The other thing on capital allocation is you've done nearly, I think, a dozen acquisitions over the course of the last couple of years. How do you decide when to invest in a company, when to purchase it, the fitment, the capital amount, the ROI on that?
Yeah.
What's the framework around that?
I can say that I have a very strong math, but honestly, you know how it is, right? I mean, sometimes you sort of do these things when you look at what your strategy is. So our approach was the following. We did a lot of these M&As at a point of time when everything happened during the pandemic era.
Mm.
A lot of companies struggle to scale, and we utilize that sort of time to look for acquisition opportunities. And we spoke to about 150, 200 plus companies at that time.
Mm.
I think every day, 2, 3, 4 companies that we'll have a conversation on,
mm.
Which led to identifying these 10, 12 companies that we sort of acquired.
Mm.
But our approach was very clear, Sandeep, that we were looking at building a lifelong learning journey that from the time you graduate from your school till the time you are 60, 70 years old, at what level, what kind of intervention would you need to move up in your journey?
Got it.
If you're studying in college, you need a product which is skilling in college.
Hmm.
If you're graduating from college, you need some online degrees and online masters or study abroad option.
Sure.
You are working someplace, you need some skilling programs and upskilling programs or executive education programs in that journey.
Hmm.
And when you are in the enterprise play, you want learning and staff, learning solution and sort of training solution.
Hmm.
Staffing ended up happening as a capability building, but it's a business in itself.
Sure.
So when we put across our strategy and the roadmap of lifelong learning, we said, these are the pockets where we are present and these are the places where we are not present.
Hmm.
And therefore, if a partner or a sort of company that comes in that will fulfill my void is how we look at M&A. It was mostly to sort of fill up the pieces of puzzle, because not everything in education, we can do it on our own.
Sure.
That was part one of it. Part two, beyond capabilities, some of the times we took certain decision to extend to a customer segment that we did not have.
Okay.
So to give a very simple example, that some M&As could have been done purely because we did not have access to a geography where we are not present in. So acha mujhe US ka presence milta hai, mere ko Southeast Asia ka presence milta hai. That's just one example. But the other way is that, okay, I was present in B2B a lot in the auto and manufacturing space, but my presence in tech was very limited.
Got it.
Can we look at M&A opportunities there?
So like distribution, acquiring distribution.
So customer segment expansion or geo / customer segment expansion and capability expansion were the two metrics around which we looked at M&A opportunities.
Makes a lot of sense.
Many places, also the other place around is that some ecosystem companies, by being part of that ecosystem, is not valued as much. And by being part of education, so for example,
Give me an example. Recruitment is a good space.
Okay. Right? Recruitment companies are not traded at a very high multiple.
Let's say revenue multiples are higher if it's a part of the
larger ecosystem, because there's a lot of value that you can get that gets unlocked, because now you have access to customers, you have access to talent, you can play the entire ecosystem game.
Yeah.
And some of the places that strategic thought came in, that look, suddenly if it is being traded at 0.5 to 1x.
Yeah.
It may not go to 10x, 15x of revenue, but can it go to 2x, 3x? Because that in itself is value enhancement for that particular industry and the asset.
When you were talking about capital efficiency in an industry where a lot of others were spending a large amount of money, at any point was that the thought that are we being too conservative? Because 21, 22 or 2021 would have been a time when you would have seen a lot of noise. Yeah. Much larger fundraising. I think Upgrad has raised about 250 million or in that ballpark, whereas some of the others have raised a couple of billion dollars.
Correct, so that's been like, I think, I don't think we have ever lived with regrets. It hasn't been about regret, but let's say the first 5 years, we did not raise any capital because we just wanted to build the product in the right way. And then when we raise capital, we were very selective selective in terms of who we want to raise and when we want to raise and how much we want to raise, because you know, in the entire thing, money comes in, but equity is the costliest, or equity is the sort of biggest thing that you can hold on to it. So that was the discipline that we are building on to this. So I don't think we ever felt that capital was an issue, because if you needed capital, capital was available. It was just that we did not want to dilute at such an early stage.
And you had
stage.
The likes of Temasek, IFC, which are very long-term
investors. So when they came in, we realized that, look, they are here. And if we want to raise something, they will be there to support us. And we don't need to sort of always keep on going back and sort of looking at raising. And that's why I think we have a very clean cap table. We had our investor that came in. It's Ronnie, me, and the ESOP pool. And and therefore, it's not as diversified cap table, because we never raised money at the early stage. And that allowed us to build the business for ourselves versus building it for somebody else. But today, I think we have a lot more responsibility with a lot of people coming in. But still, it is, at least in our mind, we know that people who have come in with a very long-term mindset. Who are here to support us and help us in building the business out.
You know, the third part of what you said, which is your ESOP pool, is very interesting to me. From my memory, it seems like one of the largest ESOP pools I've seen in the startup ecosystem, nearly 13% of the company being owned by the team. How did you arrive at that number, number one? And secondly, like, how do you decide how much should be the ESOP pool within a company?
I wish there was a math to this, but look, I think we as in when we brought people in the business, we realized that we need to ESOP them a lot more. And slowly, slowly, we did not start with, let's say, 13% to start with. And we had to add, and I think as a shareholder, we had to dilute our shareholding. But we realized that, look, if you're bringing on board in an industry which is getting created, we need people's skin in the game to believe that they will also generate wealth over a period of time. I think as an as a founder group, we believe that if people have skin in the game, if they're coming in for the right reason, they should get rewarded equally. And that's the reason why we have a largish sort of ESOP pool. But did we come out with a number 13%, 10%, 8% at the start of it? No, I think it was an ongoing process, and we kept on adding ESOPs, because even today, I believe that somebody coming in today may come in at the whatever some strike price, but they have to see a journey ahead, and they can only sort of scale up if they believe that that ESOP is going to be valuable. Otherwise, I mean, there's a saying that you hire mercenaries or you hire missionaries. I think ESOP does a good job of bridging the gap of the two and ensuring that people come in with a strong mission-oriented mindset, and they are aligned with taking the right decision. And if you believe that you're an owner of the company, I think the mindset is very different when they're executing on a day-to-day basis.
You know, one of the challenges when you speak to a lot of founders is that while from your side, the intent is great that you want more shareholders, people who are partners in the business, the oftentimes the challenge is how do you convince somebody or communicate that importance of that? And have you built an approach around that? Like, how do you tell people that what they have is going to be super valuable later? Because like in education, this is also delayed gratification.
No, I think it is tough. It's not easy. But I think some of the companies have done a good job. I mean, companies like Flipkart has done a phenomenal job in evangelizing what ESOP can do. A lot of banks that got listed, they did a good job with what ESOP has done. So there's a bit of understanding there. But despite that, it is a very big challenge to explain what ESOPs are and why should people go for ESOP. But I guess the startup ecosystem, I think post 2015, 2016, ESOP had become a good integral part of compensation package. So people are starting to understand, but many people just write it off. It's a cherry on top. But it's not what people see as compensation. But in senior leadership hiring, I think it is becoming a very, very important part of the conversation. People look at ESOP very, very strongly. And people look at ESOP with very right intent that I'm here, so I might as well make money. If I'm working in this space, I should end up with about 30, 40, 50 crore, 100 crore, whatever that amount that they have in mind, 5 crore, 10 crore. Because that wealth will allow me to take the next sort of decision in my career without keeping in mind what the salary is, what the compensation is, but what I really want to enjoy. I think people are playing. There is a bit of, I mean, as I said, it's a California gold rush in some way. But the education and knowledge is less, but people are now getting to know, and people are therefore going after companies where they believe the fundamentals are far more sharper than just an idea in itself.
So today, when you're bringing on a CXO into the company, how do you approach that split of cash versus ESOP?
So I had a math earlier. Okay. Math does not work now. Okay. So my earlier math was that whatever is your salary, take a 20% discount. I'll give you 40-60% on top ESOP.
Okay.
So if you're coming at 100,
and let's say somebody is at 1 crore elsewhere, they come in 80.
Yeah. And I give you 60 to 80 lakh worth of ESOP on top.
So you 4x what they've given up.
Correct. Yeah. So you, whatever, between 2x to 4x, depending on what stage of your journey you are in.
Sure.
That was the math. I think now it's little bit more about what ESOP they already hold, and you have to play with that ESOP amount that they're holding with their incentive, with their salary. I think my thought process has always been the following, which is that if a CXO is coming on board, they should not compromise on the quality of life that they have for themselves and for their families.
Yeah.
But if they're saving X amount of money in mutual fund, et cetera, can part of that X amount of money be saved in the form of ESOPs?
Sure.
So in some way, you are banking that part of the money as ESOP, and that ESOP will continue growing over a period of time.
Yeah.
But you have both the components. So that was the mindset that take a discount, add on top. But today, everybody holds ESOP, so the discount has gone out of question.
Yeah.
So there's no discount, but you have to just compensate.
So it's assumed that you will get. So you have to match the comp and then...
And then give the ESOP on top.
Give the ESOP. Yeah.
Gone are those sort of good old days of discount and then adding the ESOP. But I think a lot of people have made a fair bit of money. I think our first round, almost everybody got access to sort of liquidate. And many of them did choose. Those who chose today are coming back regretting. But those who did not choose are very happy today that look... hopefully in the future, it will be even more valuable.
So when you offered a secondary to the team, how did you, like, what was your advice to them? Did you ask them to take it? Did you ask them not to take it or leave it to them? Or
see, I had a dual responsibility. I had to ensure that capital gets deployed.
Yeah.
So in some way, I had to give them the push that take it, boss, because I needed a certain amount of money to go in the context of secondary. But I think we left it to the individuals themselves.
Right.
I think... The advice that I give usually, if somebody asks for a genuine sort of what kind of advice should I do, I said, whatever you have, maybe you take 10, 15, 20% at different stages and divest and get some wealth in the process. But hold on to the rest for a longer time period, because I think going all out is also not an advice that I give. But I say, okay, just do maybe 10% of your holding or 20% of your holding and then see how the progression happens, because you don't want to just exit out completely.
Yeah.
But people have taken the call either way. Some have taken a 0 to a 10, 20 to 100%.
Right.
And I think everybody has a different point of view at that point of time to figure out what they want in life at that time.
Correct. Yeah. Hindsight bias is...
Yeah. In hindsight, I can make $1 million every day.
Mayank, I guess during the entire process, there are times when you yourself were faced with that decision, whether to do a secondary of your own shares or sell some bit of your own shares that you held in Upgrad. How did you personally approach that decision?
So we had, I mean, one opportunity, and that time I did the same math that look, that I've spent, let's say, 8 years building Upgrad or 7 years building Upgrad, and maybe there was an opportunity for some kind of wealth creation. I use the same math for myself. If I'm advising somebody 15-20%, I took my math as 10% and I said, okay, about 7-8%, 10% of what I hold, I can divest and sort of get some liquidity for myself and for the family. And then the rest, 92%, 93% remains invested in the shareholding. So I come with that mindset that, look, at different points of time, a smaller portion is okay if you want like a little bit of different kind of liquidity in the ecosystem. And then beyond a certain point of time, I don't think that further liquidity helps in changing the lifestyle. There's not that much that you can change. So I think I took that decision once, and after that, if they had come in later, I've not taken the decision at that point of time. But perhaps at a different stage, I do see that maybe as a founder, my advice to others would be that look at that 5 to 15% range at different stages. But then 5 to 15% of a diminishing number over a period of time does not mean that in six rounds you take out 100%.
Correct.
But you take 15% or 5% at every different stages and get some liquidity for yourself.
You know, somebody told me that the only difference between the rich and ultra rich is whether you own your own aircraft or not. So after a point, lifestyle doesn't change.
No. I personally believe that the biggest thing about, to the word rich is just how much control do you have on your time? If you have enough control of your time, I think you are rich enough. The main thing that matters. And I think it's beyond money. It is just mentally how much you are satisfied with what you're doing.
Correct.
If you can manage your own time well, without sort of worried about something, I think you are in a very good position.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Now, the secondary that you did, I suspect you said you secured your family. Like, what were the actual deployment of capital without going into numbers? Like, how did the overall...
No, I think one big one was I never purchased a house. So, I think house was one thing. Whether it's a financially sane decision or not, I don't know. I think when I purchased to now, on paper, it definitely looks like a sane decision. But it was more for a perspective that, look, now that you have a permanent place, you can invest and make it livable the way you want to sort of do that. Sure. So I think that was one part of it. The second big chunk for me was, I would not call it ecosystem giving, but my way of educating myself. So a second big chunk went into the startup ecosystem, either as writing small checks. I'm not a very sort of prolific investor, but in small amounts I've invested. But it's a decent chunk that has gone into startups, whether as an LP, whether as direct investment, whether in part of some funds, etc.
So LP is where you are investing into a fund. And then there are direct angel investments that you would have done to founders that you probably knew.
Correct. Yeah. So I think that's the second big chunk. Then the third one for me went into equities, mutual funds, and some debt instruments. And that those are the three broad buckets in which I can sort of break down. Some went into listed, some went into unlisted, just to get an exposure of the various places. And then I've kept a very small chunk, not for myself, but like between me and my wife, largely my wife, where she can experiment with what's happening in the market, largely in the equity space. So I think we are still very long on equity and we are very long on risky equity with the fact that Upgrade is equally sort of in that zone. Sure. So I think given the age and the stage where we are, we have taken the choice that, look, we are okay with being slightly long on equities and direct equity exposure rather than going into bonds and debt right now.
And in this journey, Mayank, how do you decide who is a good wealth manager? What are the way you evaluate a wealth manager?
No, it's a very tricky thing. Maybe just as a disclosure, I do sort of engage with you guys in a different manner, but
I left it to you to say that.
But I'll tell you why. I mean, maybe that is a good way of explaining why I went with what you guys sort of bring in. I think one interesting thing that I got after meeting sort of you guys was that I did not hear anything that I did not understand. So because I understood, it was very easy for me to take a decision. Because sometimes when the conversation starts, when you start using the word synthetic, blended, hybrid, this, that, etc., and I just don't know anything, and then I just lose interest. And I think one of the key things that I look for is how authentic and how direct and how clear that wealth manager is that they bring to the table. But after that, you have to track performance. So in the context of performance, you always look for how the fund is performing, etc. And I've taken a decision that wealth management is not a day-to-day thing. I can't look at day-to-day. I think even looking at month is a stupid thing to do. And in the process, what ends up happening, Sandeep, is that when you're looking at things, you feel, "Arey yaar, toh kuch ho hi nahi rahe." Because I think working with you guys, one of the things that I've realized that it's very bland and very boring. And that's the thing that I like. Personally, that's my sort of style also, that I know that what you guys are putting in has a long-term conviction, has a long-term thought. And therefore, I look for partners who are very stable and wealth managers who are very stable and who will do things in a very simple, easy to understand and with not too much of jazz that is coming in. I feel that history has taught the same thing, that if you are in the stable thing, it sort of works out well. And the advices that I get also matters at time to time, what people bring to the table. And I think that's the thing that I like. It's little bit, not that much of churn and not that much of changes. And plus what you told was easy to understand.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. I think, you know, the internal philosophy we had around this is what Charlie Munger said, is that you know, find out where you're going to die and just don't go there.
Yeah.
So for us, it's about not making mistakes, which everyone has made in the past. I think one thing that you probably don't know is today we have more than a few thousand clients, but you were our cold start problem solution. you sort of solved it for us. You were one of our early customers, and thank you so much for that.
I remember, I think early days when everybody was coming with this blended, that blended, and you said, okay, just do mutual funds.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, fine. That I understand, that I can really sort of buy the product from right now.
No, thank you so much. And thanks for hosting us at UpGrad. It's been a fantastic conversation.
Perfect.
I really appreciate this.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.